Listeners, this is Symposium, episode 6, the number that looks just like a section sign. Music for dowsing today. We will end the season in a similar way as we started it. As some of you may have noticed, the thick sound carpet of our program 1 included samples from Alvin Lucier's Music on a Long Thin Wire from 1977. Surely an amuletic recording for many of you. Tonight, we will listen again to Alvin Lucier, this time lecturing, in a very casual and irresistible way, about his musical experimentations and the connections of his music with geographical concerns. In October 2009, Lucier was invited as an artist in residency by the Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, where he gave a remarkable lecture illustrated with excerpts of his music. I have listened to this recording many times, feeling like one of those imaginary geography students, the only difference being that I was in my bathtub, or, these last days, in the New York subway system. However, my commentary this time will be brief. I have simply gathered a few bullet points following the stations of Lucier's speech. Number 1. Alvin Lucier starts, quite inescapably I should say, recounting the genealogy of his first masterpiece from 1965. He was about 27 years old at that time. A work that used amplified brainwaves of the alpha type to move a set of percussion instruments connected to his nervous system by electrodes. Alpha waves are known to be those the human brain emits when reaching a meditative state. If you don't know what that is like, imagine a balanced mix of awareness and deep tranquility. Zen practitioners know about this state quite well, and in fact, every time I listen to Music for Solo Performer, that's the title of Lucier's early work, I remember Sensei Daisen Deshimaru demonstrating alpha waves on a television stage in France sometime during the 1970s or early 1980s. If Deshimaru encountered difficulties to reach the meditative state and start emitting alpha, which he did all right, you may think that Lucia's efforts to produce the same waves on a theater stage, frontally facing the audience, had to be enormous. In order for the piece to be prepared and performed, Lucier used one of those brainwave amplifiers that were developed for biofeedback training, which means developed for people to train themselves in cultivating the alpha state of mind and fighting anxiety. Thanks to the amplifier, the right state of mind becomes manifest to the user and can be maintained. An old Zen proverb says that every word finds its roots in silence. Lucia's piece helps us understand the nature of that silence, that of alpha waves that cannot be heard otherwise. When alpha waves become manifest by using the amplifier, the mental domain finds a correlate in physical space. Paradoxically, reaching this state of mental silence, the mind seems to start speaking with percussive phrases. Alpha waves are produced by the meditative, concentrated mind that does not follow the thread of words memories, erratic tunes, and other miasma. If silence is the truth, this silence has, nevertheless, a wavelength. The power of this silence is such that if a prisoner is able to keep her or his mind at ease and produce alpha waves, her mind can fool enemy lie detectors. A work of music made with and out of alpha waves must sound basically like the music of truth. The sound of music for solo performer varies depending precisely on the actual performer, making the amplified alpha hit the percussions with different rhythms and intensities. In some cases, the least successful, it sounds like someone moving furniture. In the best cases, such as Lucier's own performance in Oakland, California, in 2012, a thunderstorm seems to take place on stage with an intensity and duration only comparable to the day-long drumming sessions in the Spanish village of Calanda. Number 2. Alvin Lucier refers to his signature work, I Am Sitting in a Room, several times during his chat, but he does not play any excerpts. That's why I decided to have some of it playing in the background right now. I have always thought, pretty much since I was born, that the first line of the text, I am sitting in a room different from the one you are in now, is the very mantra of sound recording. The sentence every recording spells out, even when there is no speech, no voice. Number 3. I shoot an arrow, and where it falls, there is my target. Number 4. Lucier used handheld echolocation devices in another one of his works, the one titled Vespers, where performers used resonance to map the theater space and orient themselves in it. They look for the center of the room, but in a way, they move like dowsers, as dowsers also walk on and through the non-visual plane, searching. Certainly, divining rods and echolocation devices are totally different animals, but the stance is related. And yet, on another line, the way Lucier describes his process of research and conception of each project may well be compared to dowsing. But going back to Vespers, the end of the piece is marked by the symmetry of resonance, with waves coming out of and returning to the center of the room. Number 5. The apex of Lucier's chat comes around minute 11, when he speaks about the importance the term sound geography has for him, a term that pervades his oeuvre and that he has used in some works in the past. Alvin Lucier is the musician whose works are maps and whose performances are the enactment, the projections of those maps into space. In other words, three-dimensional maps projected at scale 1, but invisible. Number 6. One of the most beautiful episodes Alvin Lucier speaks about is his recording of ionospheric signals in Boulder, Colorado. These ionospheric signals are radio waves falling into the audible range for human ears, although they can only be heard and recorded in certain contexts, power and noise clean. The ionosphere is in fact responsible for many electromagnetic phenomena, among which my favorite is so-called ionospheric ducting, an unproven phenomenon somewhat related to the realm of psychic sound or EVP. So-called ionospheric ducts may bring bits of a radio broadcast to a listener located thousands of miles away from the reception range. It is even said that ionospheric ducting can mirror radio broadcasts into the future or delay the reception of something that was broadcast, say, 4 years ago, say, in Kingston, Canada, like we are doing right now.
Shall I just start?
Go ahead, maestro.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know where to start exactly. My so-called experiments are always aimed at performance. I'm a musician to begin with. I give concerts and sound installation. So I really don't pursue experimentation for the sake of that. It's always, I get an idea and I try to make it into a piece of music that can be performed. So all these experiments in sound and pickups and so forth, I just never pursued that. I made one piece after another. The first piece of any interest in that regard is my brainwave piece. I came home from Europe as a student and didn't have any ideas. I didn't have any compositional ideas. I heard a lot of European music at that time, and although I admired it a lot, it didn't resonate with me at all. I knew it was someone else's music, not my own. And so I was looking for something that I could call my own instead of imitating European models of music. And I met a scientist, actually. Now, I'm not a scientist in any way. I never did very well in school in physics. Certain things I just didn't understand, and I still don't understand them. But that's held me in good stead because I look at things from a different perspective. For example, when I'm sitting in a room, scientists will say, oh, I can do that. I know that. That's just room acoustics. I can't to this day tell you exactly why the frequencies that come from my speech in that room are the way they are. But I have a feeling about it. That's held me in good stead as a composer and not as a scientist, if you understand what I mean. And I met this scientist, and he was prowling around the music department where I was teaching. And he had a brainwave amplifier, and he was doing experiments with alpha waves as it related to aircraft pilots who were flying propeller airplanes. When they would land, the propellers were spinning slowly at such slow speeds that for some pilots who were prone to epilepsy, the visual sunlight going through the propellers would lock onto a brainwave that would cause mild epileptic fits, and these pilots were blacking out. And the Air Force asked him to try to figure that out, and he did. And in doing so, he had this enormous amplifier about this big. Now alpha biofeedback amplifiers. This was a huge amplifier. And he said, you know, I've been trying to interest the other composers in the music department here to do something with brainwaves, and they think it's silly. I said, well, I don't have any ideas at this moment, so I don't think it's silly. I think it's interesting. And I borrowed his amplifier, and I spent many hours trying to produce alpha. We know that alpha is one of the brainwaves that can be unblocked by non-visualization. If you get in a meditative state where you're not thinking about anything, if that's possible, it's not really possible, but you can try to do your alpha waves. Now, you have to realize they're electrical energy signals that are in all our brains. I remember Pauline Oliveros used to say, ah, your piece proves that we all have little electronic studios in our heads. We have these waves bumping along. We don't know they're there, but they're there. Now, do we know they're there? I don't think so. She claimed that monks who in Asia who chant at very low frequencies, she says they're trying to sing the frequency of their alpha waves. She thinks it's that. I'm not quite sure it is, but anyway. So I made this piece where I could sit with electrodes on my scalp. I didn't know too much about it. I tried different things, sticking them here, sticking them there. I read a little bit about it. And when I was getting alpha, I could see the cones of the loudspeakers. First, the meters on the tape recorder would bump, and alpha waves go about 10 cycles a second. Now, that's below audibility as far as musical tone is concerned. But it's certainly you hear the individual bumps and pulses. I'm sort of rambling a little bit, but that's the way it is. You'll have to deal with it. And I knew I was getting alpha, and I saw the cones of the loudspeakers bumping, going in and out visibly. Usually loudspeakers, you're not supposed to exercise them in that way. So to make a piece of music, I thought, well, what do I do? I mean, I'm a composer, first of all. So that those experiments weren't the end of my interest. I wanted to make a performance piece. I thought, what do I do? All my colleagues said, oh, you should record these signals and go in a studio and splice them up and make a tape piece. I thought about that. That's a safe way to go, isn't it? You can record them under ideal conditions and you have miles of tape. You can splice. In the old days, you spliced tape together and made different things. And I thought to myself, but that is an interesting performance. It's okay, you can make a tape piece, you go into a concert, I could put it on a CD, I could play it for you now, and it would be okay. But I thought, what's much more interesting is a human being sitting in front of an audience generating alpha in real time. So that's dangerous, because sometimes it doesn't happen. Sitting in front of an audience, you don't get in that state of mind that releases the alpha waves. But I thought, what a beautiful performance situation that is. I mean, every day in medical buildings, people are having EEGs, you know, electroencephalograms. So it's a touching human experience. But then what do I do? Do I just have the alpha coming out of loudspeakers? What do I want to do to vary it? I thought, well, you don't have to vary it because it's varied by itself. The alpha waves are 10 cycles a second, like that low sound. But they rise and fall a little bit. They stop, they burst, they get louder. They do a number of interesting things. And it's nature. It's like if you watch a river, you don't need to dam it up to make it interesting. It's interesting the way it flows. So I thought of the brainwaves as flowing natural signals coming out of my brain. And then I thought, what do I do for a performance? And I was an old percussion player. I was always played snare drum in bands and stuff like that. So I thought, well, I saw those cones of those loudspeakers doing work. They were actually doing physical work. I thought they could play drums. So my piece, instead of cutting up or deconstructing in any way the alpha rhythm, which I thought was natural and beautiful, I simply orchestrated it through 16 or so channels of loudspeakers, each speaker pushed up against drums, cymbals, gongs, bass drums, things of that kind. So that was the way I, what's the word, orchestrated, composed that piece. Even the night before the first performance, I got very anxious. I thought, what am I doing? I'm a composer. I went to school. I know about forms and structures and so forth. And here I am, I'm just sitting there in front of an audience, just letting my alpha waves flow out. So that piece was very important. I'm trying to think why I talked about this piece, where I was going with that argument. Yes, it reveals something that's in our heads all the time, but we don't know it's there. We're not aware of our alpha waves, I don't think. On the other hand, we may be in some way. So I would have to say that the rest of my life, it was a long time ago, that was 1965, if you can believe it, that. The rest of my life has been, in composition, has been making pieces that reveal unheard sounds. This gentleman talked about subconscious and sounds around us that we hear but we don't relate to somehow. My work is even at a lower level than that. It's sounds that exist that we don't hear, and one of them is room resonances. Now, of course, we do hear room resonances. My voice in this space is different than it is in another space. When I used to teach at Brandeis University, I remember I always used to stand in the same place in the room when I taught, because it was under a resonant, some sort of acoustical situation that my voice sounded stronger and gave me more confidence. So you are aware of room resonances, but not completely. Wouldn't you love to hear what this room sounds like exactly? I mean, every sound has a sound wave, a palpable physical sound wave. The low note A on the piano has a 10-foot wavelength. Actually, the sounds go out into space pushing air molecules in groups of 10 feet. If you tune a sine wave, if I had a sine wave oscillator here, a sine wave is a wave that's pure without any overtones. I could tune a sine wave here so that you could see, you could hear, you could feel where the nodes and antinodes of that wave are in this room. I made a piece for dancers where I would tune a sine wave that would come out of a pair of loudspeakers. And if the room is dry enough, if there's not a lot of reverberation, you can actually walk in the valleys of quiet sound and the crests of loud sound, okay? The higher the frequency, the smaller the shorter the wavelength. So sound for me became palpable and physical. And I didn't think of notes on the page as being high or low or going from left to right on a page of music. And I didn't even think of them as high or low. I thought of them as fast vibrations and slower vibrations and where they physically can be placed in space. Now, the word geography comes up. I've been trying to think where I use the word sound geography. I'm trying to think where I used it in a title of a piece and so forth, but I can't remember. But I did make this piece where dancers would start behind a pair of loudspeakers and walk and then try to find troughs of quiet sound and walk in them by listening to loudness here and loudness here and walking in those troughs. They happen to appear in space in hyperbolic curves. That's just the way it is. If you tuned one sine wave coming out of a pair of loudspeakers, it takes longer for this speaker to get to a point with this speaker. You can see this wave is going out, that wave is going this way and out to it, so that you have hyperbolic geometric lines going out like this between two speakers. And I call out those sound geographies, actual sound waves, making physical, palpable, sculptural manifestations in space. I'm talking about a bunch of things at the same time, but they're all the same thing in a certain way. So my works involved often revealing sounds that are there, but you're not aware of them, or you may be partially aware of them. After I did I'm Sitting in a Room, which I have here, and I didn't know you were going to play parts of it, I made a piece called Vespers. And Vespers was a piece involving echoes in a room. I mean real echoes. I don't mean imitation echoes. I mean real physical echoes. I found devices called sondals. You know, when you're on a case and you're interested in a phenomenon, you miraculously find ways to... People come forward and give you materials that you need. I had a dream one night that I was on another planet. This is a science fiction dream. We all have them, one way or another. And I'm up in this other environment, talking about an environment, which was, I don't know whether it was physical or psychological or philosophical. And I had some sort of musical sound-producing object. I should have brought my sondals, but I didn't, that's all. And I'm playing the environment. I have these devices that send pulse waves out into the space that bounce off the walls and ceilings and floors of the space, returning as echoes. And you can see that when the wave returns to you, you can tell how far away something is. Sound goes 1,100 feet a second, something like that. So if an echo comes back to you in 1 second, for example, you know that the object off of which it reflects is 500, 600 feet away. It takes time for the pulse wave to go out and return. I read a book on bats, a popular book by a scientist from Harvard called Echoes of Bats and Men. And he describes how bats use echolocation to survive. They don't see very well at night. In fact, they don't see at all, I don't think. And they send out pulse trains of sharp, short sounds. Sounds need to be short so that you can hear the echo that comes back. If the sound is long, you don't hear the echo. And these bats send out these enormously high-frequency, fast pulse trains. And they, between each pulse, a bat can send out about 50,000 pulses per second, even more than that. As they send out each pulse, their ears open and close. imagine opening and closing your ears 50,000 times a second, because the sound they send out is so loud, they have to close their ears. The echo that comes back is weaker, so they open their big ears. So these bats can survive by sound. I thought that was a wonderful idea, because in those days, the idea of what a piece of music is was up for grabs. Is music entertainment? Is it song form? Is it harmony, melody, and rhythm? Is it got to be played by musical instruments? What else could happen? And I'm talking about the 1960s now, was this great opening up of possibilities that anything could be a piece of music. You could even think about a piece of music and that would be enough. There was a genre of work called conceptual music. All you needed to do was to give an idea, and that would be a piece of music. So there was a genre of prose scores, which a composer would tell you what a piece of music might be, and that was enough to make it a piece of music. Some of the prose scores were impossible. You couldn't execute them. Some were descriptions of making music, making pieces. So I thought, gee, it would be great to have some instruments that would be like what the bats, pulse waves. And, oh, that's impossible. One night I was in a bar in Arlington, Massachusetts at night, and I happened to be talking about this. You know, when you're interested in something, your antenna are open, and everything that you perceive relates to your idea if you're passionate about it. You want to do a piece about such and such. So you go around and you're thinking about that all the time. So something from the environment may come to you and excite you about that and give you an idea. So I was in a bar talking to a guy, and I said, I read this book by this Harvard professor about bats, echolocation. Wonderful how bats and whales and dolphins use sound waves to orient themselves, to survive, actually. He said, oh, I work for a company that's manufacturing these handheld pulse wave oscillators for blind people. And I said, you do? Could you get me one? He said, yes, I'll loan you a prototype. So he brought it the next day or sometime after that, and I had in my hands a battery-operated pulse wave oscillator, which could send out beautiful, sharp clicks whose speed I could vary, and it made gorgeous echoes, clear echoes from the walls and ceilings. Outdoors, you could get echoes from objects about a quarter of a mile away, and it was beautiful. I thought, here's my piece. All I needed was the equipment, and my piece materialized. So I bought four of them, and I thought, now what? I have these four devices. What do I do to make a piece of music out of them? And I was invited to Ann Arbor, Michigan, by Robert Ashley, composer, who had a festival called the Once Festival. And I said, I don't have a new piece. I don't know what to do. I said, well, I could do this piece with echoes, and I didn't know quite how to orchestrate it. I didn't know what to do with it. So I flew out there. I still didn't know. The night before the concert, I didn't know what the piece was going to be. But I went into the space. It was a large ballroom, and I had four sandals. I had four players. They weren't musicians at all. They were actors or filmmakers or whatever. And even 10 minutes before the concert, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. So I took each one physically and I placed them in the room. So-and-so in the back of the room, so-and-so over here. And I blindfolded them and I said to them, listen, your task is not to play these instruments like musical instruments, but to use the echoes to tell you where you are and where to go. So I built into the score a task idea. Instead of orchestrating the piece saying, player number one plays for 1 minute at this speed, player number three does this, I said, your task is to move through the audience, there were aisles, and get to a central point without seeing. So I put obstacles in the space. There were stacked chairs. You know how they stack chairs up? I rolled those in. I had big plants that I put in so that there'd be obstacles for these players to avoid. if they could, by hearing the echoes that come back to them. If you're aiming at this wall here, the echo comes back very fast, and you know there's a wall there. If you're aiming at that wall, the echoes are not so fast because it's farther away. One of the beauties of this piece was time and space were directly related. The time it took for the echo to go out from the performer back to the performer depended on the space, how far away the player was to the wall. So it's not an idea of like slowing down and speeding up because you think it sounds good. It's slowing down and speeding up to measure your relationship to the walls and the ceiling in space. So that for me was a wonderful, liberating idea because I didn't have to think about aesthetics. Fast, slow, slowing down, speeding up, the old idea of accelerando, decelerando. It was purely practical and physical, which idea I liked a lot. Before the performance, I had a pair of shoes on by accident that had leather soles. So the audience is sitting there. I turn out the lights. I walk around the space. You can hear the echoes from my feet a little bit. A little bit. Audience wasn't aware of that so much. There were drapes on the windows. I opened them up so that it would be a more reverberant space. Drapes and dampenings, opening them up. Then I placed each player physically. I took them by the hand, placed them, and then I sat down, and they played this piece. So that was the piece. Afterward, I wrote a score, a prose score, describing the situation and what players can do. So that was a piece that directly had to do with space. I may have, if you give me a second here to see if I have it. I bring every CD I have except the one I need. Okay, I was going to play I'm Sitting in a Room, but since you already played part of it in the presentation, I don't have to play it. So instead of pursuing that idea completely, I'm a composer, you know, I'm more of a composer than an explorer in a certain way. And I had to make pieces, you know, to survive. And I made my brainwave piece, and I made I'm Sitting in a Room. And this echolocation piece was called Vespers, V-E-S-P-E-R-S. It had to do with evening. It's an evening church service, isn't it? Vespers. It's also the name of the common bat of North America, Vespertilione Day. So I gave it that kind of quality. This is a performance of Vespers that we did as for a recording in a stone building, an art gallery at Brandeis University, limestone, I think. And the players were instructed to orient themselves acoustically by monitoring their echoes. Let it go for a while, just to get an idea of the sound. You can hear the room. Okay, that's all right. You get an idea of what the sound is like. Okay, let's switch gears now. She mentioned space, didn't she? I go in the summer to Colorado, and I'll just tell you what I did. I made two antennas out of wood, 4 feet long, notched antennas. I went to a Radio Shack and bought number 18 hookup wire and wound it 5 times around each antenna, making what's called a large loop antenna. And I bought a couple of little transformers, I didn't know terribly much about it, and plugged the antennas into the microphone inputs of a Sony cassette tape recorder. And I drove my antennas up to the top of a mountain in an effort to receive electromagnetic signals from the ionosphere. Now, at night, the ionosphere comes down several hundred miles close to the Earth, and all the time in the ionosphere are electromagnetic storms, and they produce signals in the audible range. They're not sound waves, they're radio waves, but they're in the audible range of human hearing. They're basically storms that create three or four different kinds of signals. Scientists call them tweaks, bonks, swishes, and whistlers. Those are the scientific terms. A tweak is a short burst of electromagnetic energy. A bonk is a tweak that echoes off the Earth and back from the ionosphere to the Earth and back, creating a resonance signal. A whistler can only be picked up at certain places on Earth. A whistler sounds like this. In the Thomas Pynchon novel V, I think, or Gravity's Rainbow, talks about a whistler station somewhere, South Africa. But you can pick them up anywhere slightly. What happens with the whistler is it's a tweak or a bonk that gets caught on the magnetic flux lines that go from the North Pole to the South Pole. So the whistler travels down the whole length of the Earth. So I thought it would be great to record these. Well, the big problem is that if you set up an antenna like outside, you'd get 60-cycle hum. You'd get all the signals from electricity in the city. So it's impossible. So I had to find a place on a mountaintop where there were no power lines. It's almost impossible to find those nowadays because power is everywhere. So I kept driving up and I would set up my antenna and take a listen. I'd get at a radio station. I'd drive up a few more miles, not to get close to the ionosphere, but to get away from power. Finally, I got to the top and I simply set up my antennas 10 or 12 feet apart. I had called the ionospheric lab for the United States Department in Boulder, Colorado. And any American citizen, you're supposed to be able to get any information you want. So I called them up and said, I'm going to record spherics. They said, yes, we know what those are. I said, how do I get stereo? The man said, we don't know anything about stereo, sir. I said, do I have to put an antenna in the Antarctic and put another one in South Africa to get stereo? He said, I have no information about that. Well, I discovered simply you just put them 10, 12 feet apart and aim them in different directions. So I got beautiful stereo reception. So I started recording at like 11 at night. At nighttime, they start sparsely and they get stronger and stronger throughout the night. And then at dawn, they sparsen out a little bit. So I sat up all night changing the cassettes. It was the best cassette recorder I could find at that time. And I recorded like 8 hours of spherics. They're called spherics, S-F-E-R-I-C-S. And I made a recording. Let's see if I can find it now. Okay, I'm going to go back so you can hear the whistler. You can hear a slight whistler about 4 seconds in. I was lucky to get it. Try to hear it. Thank you. Okay, they segued into a different piece. Well, those are spherics. I did an installation of these with a 6 pair of antennas in El Moro, New Mexico. And it was wonderful because cassette recorders were battery operated. I didn't have to plug it in. And you could see lightning in the distance, and it would be simultaneously with a spheric. During the First World War, the Allies were monitoring enemy lines by having antennas and radio receivers. And at night they heard these sounds and they wondered what they were. And they were spherics. I also did in El Moro the installation of huge barbed wire fences that stretched for miles. So I hooked the wire of my antenna to the barbed wire fence and came into my tape recorder and I used the barbed wire fence as a large antenna. There's an idea that rivers can be antennas also. I thought of doing an experiment where I would use a river as an antenna, but I never did it. I made this piece. This is an 8-minute version. Every minute I splice. There was no way to splice this piece because it was so rich and dense in its material. Did you hear high frequencies there that were periodic? Those are man-made. There used to be something now called the Omega Navigational System, which was a set of 10 or 11 points on Earth, including some ships at sea, that would send out these signals for aircraft pilots called Omni, the Omni signal. Aircraft pilots used to navigate by hearing by seeing the Omni signal in their cockpit and knowing where they were. I don't think they need to do that anymore. You know, nobody passes a law that says you can do this. All of a sudden, there's this 10, 12,000 cycle signals that are just in our environment that no one agreed to. Nobody voted on it, and it just happens to be there. The U.S. Navy does terrible things with low-frequency sound waves under the ocean. They didn't have to consult us and say, is it okay to do that? So it's causing great disturbances with animal life in the ocean. But anyway, these high-frequency periodic signals, there was no way I could splice them out. Because if you splice them out, you splice out the high-frequency material. So I just allowed them to stay there. I walked around for years singing and whistling those frequencies. You know how a tune gets in your head? You can't get it out. I'd go around whistling. Similar to those signals. Was everyone able to hear those? I can't hear them anymore. When you get older, your high frequencies go, your perception of high frequencies aren't as good as, but I sang these signals. I'd go around, it was driving me crazy. So one year I got a commission from a quartet, a string quartet, the Arditti String Quartet. This is music now. This isn't sound art. And they said, would you write a piece for the Arditti String Quartet? And I thought, oh gosh. But right away I thought, aha, I'll take my condensation of those signals. And I notated them as the notes A, A flat, B flat, and G, if you know what those are. And I made a piece where the string quartet would repeat those pitches over and over again, each time changing the frequency microscopically, lowering and raising, until at the end of the piece there's a single pitch between the four notes. And at the end they would go quieter and quieter so that the pitch would disappear into the air conditioning in the room or something. It was my idea of expelling those frequencies that were haunting my brain for so many years. In doing so, if two pitches are tuned closely, really closely, almost the same pitch, you can hear interference patterns, audible beating, which is when the two sound waves coincide. If you have a frequency going 100 cycles a second and another one going 101 cycles a second, every second they're going to come into phase and you'll hear a bump. It's an audible beat. It's a rhythm. So I've worked with that for many years, that idea, by tuning an instrument with an oscillator or two or three instruments together, creating interference patterns. The farther apart they are, the faster the beating, the closer they are, the slower the beating. At unison, there's no beating. So I made this piece with the four stringed instruments, starting on those pitches, dee-da-dee-da. And I had to check, because there have been many pieces written using people's initials, like Bach, B-A-C-H. There's many composers have made pieces with B-A-C-H. H is a B-flat in German. So I had to check. I don't want to steal that idea. I want my own idea. So I took the spherix. This is kind of far-fetched, okay, but I'm a composer. I can do this. I took those pitches, and I had the players repeat them over and over again, microscopically, impossibly tuning them. They're impossible for the players to hear, but I still wrote it that way so that they would try to do it. Irvine Arditti, the director, I said, Irvine, this piece is impossible to play. He said, oh, we can do the impossible. It's a very difficult we can't do. So that's supposed to be a joke. So anyway, let me play the beginning of this piece. This is called Navigations for Strings. I took the Omni signals, compressed them into four pitches, and made a piece for a string quartet. Stop it. You get the idea? Okay, anyone want to ask me anything? I've meandered around today. I'm sorry I've been sort of disorganized, but that's the way I am. I did a piece with brainwaves, uncovered sounds that you never heard before that are there in your heads all the time. Did a piece with echolocation, hearing the signature of a room through the reverberation. I'm sitting in a room which articulates the resonant frequencies of a room, and spherics, which is sounds from space echoing off the earth. And then a string quartet, which is a conventional musical form which uses those signals in an indirect way. There must be some questions. Yes?
I've heard people recording Northern Lights. Would that work in the same way?
I did an experiment in Alaska for a Japanese television program about the millennium. Theoretically, Northern Lights are supposed to influence spherics. And we went up to Alaska and went up on a mountaintop with my antennas and waited for the clouds to clear, and the Northern Lights appeared. But I couldn't hear much influence at all. Is it time to go?
Yes, it is time to go for all of us. As I mentioned, this is the last symposium of the season on WGXC, 90.7 on your FM or your laptop. We will be back in 6 months with more symposia, more voices, and more philosophical discotheque. Until then, take care of yourselves. I haven't found a better exit music than a sound work by artist José Antonio Orts, titled Chromosphere, premiering now on American radio. The piece uses sound material collected by a sculpture. The material is the amplified echo of spectators wandering inside an exhibition space. Enjoy.